From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. It may be hard to predict, but today we'll explore what the economic impact of the RNC might look like. Then we'll learn how Milwaukee County Parks redesigned McKinley Beach to make it safer for swimmers.
We did the most we could to address all we could and bring this wading beach back to its original design, because we feel that that shallower water allows for less wave run-up, which keeps swimmers safer.
We'll tell you about UW-Madison researchers who are using mannequins to learn how best to spot ticks.
The average success rate when we took these out for the surveys, we had 16 ticks that were attached to them, and the average found was 7.
Plus, we'll learn about Carroll University's animal behavior program. All that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll learn about the changes made to McKinley Beach to keep swimmers safe now that it's reopened to the public. But we'll start with this number, $200 million. That's how much money organizers of the RNC are projecting will flow into Milwaukee because of the convention. A similar number was estimated for Cleveland, which hosted the RNC in 2016. Sarah Volpenheim is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was reporting in Cleveland when they hosted the RNC 8 years ago. Recently, she returned to Cleveland to get a better picture of the economic impact a convention has on a city. She joins Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to share what she found.
The convention in Cleveland was sold, like most of them are, as a major economic driver, that it would be very good for businesses and would have something on the order of a $200 million economic impact on the region in both direct and indirect spending. It was promoted a lot as something that was good for the city, as something that would benefit businesses and promote a positive image of the city that maybe people weren't familiar with and would help drive tourism to the city.
And then when it all shook out, what was the lasting impact on the city?
It depends who you ask. The host committee did commission a couple of economic impact studies after the fact that found kind of a varying range of impact. So anywhere from $130 to $190 million in economic impact from the convention. But also economists who study these kinds of mass events like national political conventions found that they tend to be a lot more skeptical of those kinds of economic impact studies, and they tend to say that they overestimate the actual impact of those events. A lot of the people I talked to locally said that they thought it did ultimately benefit the city, mostly on the image factor, and that it presented a positive image of the city to the rest of the country.
You talked about the host committee and the pitch. How did the host committee pitch the economic impacts of the RNC here in Milwaukee?
Yeah, it was a very similar dynamic. The host committee here and a lot of politicians that helped promote the city as the host city for the RNC said that it would be good for business. It would give the city a chance to shine a positive light on everything that makes Milwaukee great. It would ultimately provide positive economic impact for the city. So it was a very similar story, and I think they even used the same figure of $200 million for the estimated economic impact that we might see from the convention.
Mm-hmm. Some of your most recent reporting has looked at local businesses here in Milwaukee, and maybe with surprising results. I'm thinking of restaurants and venues very close to the security zone that are projected to be big losers when we're talking about revenue and economic impact. What did you learn there, and who is looking at shortcomings financially?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really hard to tell before the convention gets here what the impact will be for those businesses that are very close to the security zone or within it. What I heard from businesses in Cleveland that might be like a presage of what we see here is that the businesses within the security zone and very close to the venue will likely see a lot of business and have a lot of foot traffic. what's interesting here in Milwaukee is that a lot of those businesses haven't seen much bookings in advance of the convention, but it's still possible that during the convention, they see a lot of foot traffic from not only delegates, but protesters, media, other people who are here to voice their thoughts and opinions. In Cleveland, I talked to a bunch of businesses in a neighborhood called Ohio City that's about a 20-minute walk from their convention site. And those businesses said that it was a ghost town during the 4 days of the convention, that no one was out, that they actually saw a drop in business from a typical summer day, that they were very taken aback by this, given all of the talk about how great this would be for businesses and how relatively close they are to the convention site. So it could be that something similar transpires in the Third Ward, which is about the same distance as Ohio City is from the convention site. And I guess we'll have to see what happens.
The interesting thing is, too, is when I saw that, it feels like people will stay away from those areas because of the idea of like large crowds or traffic, which in actuality, there may not be large crowds or traffic because so many people would be avoiding those areas at that time.
At least in Cleveland's experience, they didn't anticipate a lot of the loss of business that some of the surrounding areas would see because of the excess crowds, the traffic restrictions. A lot of roads were closed, or it maybe was confusing for residents which roads were closed, and just the general fear of unrest, because at least in Cleveland leading up to the convention, Donald Trump was kind of a newer entity. This was the first time that he had run for public office, and people were very worried at that time that there would be another 1968, a reference to the DNC riots in Chicago. So there was a lot of fear and anxiety kind of leading up to the convention about what it would look like.
Yeah, we don't have any of that this time around. So you also talked to the PAPS group, which kept their books kind of open, and they're expected to lose like around 100,000 throughout this. And if you can fill me in a little bit more about these contracts that venues sign to keep their spaces open for the RNC, is this a normal thing that host committees usually do? And then how responsible is a host committee to help make sure that those businesses are seeing business through the RNC or not?
I don't know how common those contracts are for host committees. We didn't look into that. And I don't have a copy of the contracts that some of these businesses signed, so I don't know the entire scope of it. We did ask the businesses that we talked to for copies, and they declined to provide those. But what we were told, my colleague and I, was that the contracts basically required the venues to set aside their venues for the days of the convention, give or take a few, and hold them basically for convention-related bookings. There was an opt-out clause where they could apply if, say, they had an inquiry for a day in the convention to opt out of the contract for that day or for that event. What the businesses told us was that they kept being told the business is coming, just wait. They just kept being told to wait.
I want to play some tape for you of someone who I talked with, and he's kind of like the go-to guy when it comes to the economic impact of national conventions. I'm sure you have heard of him.
This is Victor Matheson. I'm a professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Victor pretty much said there are these two types of research that can be done around the conventions. The type that study ahead of time and try to guess how much revenue a convention will make. I think that's kind of this $200 million number that we're seeing here in Milwaukee. He said that usually doesn't include costs, which seems like a big deal to include when you're looking at economic impact. But then he also said there's a study that academics like himself and his team does, which looks back at the past conventions, which you've also done. And he said that one of the ways to measure impact is through hotel stays and hotel money. And there's this real bump that happens. The number that he gave was $20 million, which isn't quite $200 million, as has been promised or projected here. And he also said that there are clear winners and clear losers when it comes to this party coming to town.
And there's some real winners and losers here. Hotel folks, definitely winners. If you are a local local law enforcement. You get a lot of overtime pay here. You're looking forward to that. But the losers are the sort of businesses that usually are cater to other types of tourists, folks who cater to just a regular clientele. Imagine the old TV show Cheers, right? The regulars coming into the bar. Those are the ones who get crowded out by these sort of events. And the real question is whether that activity gets replaced by delegates or not.
Mm. There is this crowding out effect of these big political conventions where the typical people that who would go out and shop or go out to restaurants on these days kind of get crowded out. A lot of businesses that I've talked to have said that they're not expecting any of their regulars the days of the convention because they expect them to kind of go out of town, or they've been told this by their regulars. The question, like he said, is that replaced by the convention business or not? The other thing he touched on was the ways that police organizations benefit from this. Yeah, there is something to that. I'm sure there is a lot of overtime that officers get from this. It's a massive event and one that has national security implications. So there will be thousands of police officers on the ground in Milwaukee, not just from the city, but from around the state, from other states entirely, that will be on the ground here. That's money in their pockets. Also, any host city gets a grant from the federal government to stock up on supplies that they might need to police the convention. So what I heard from the police chief in Cleveland was that they were able to get 300 new bicycles for their bike cop units, which he saw as a real win that they were able to get that kind of equipment for their people.
As you're talking about all the police that were coming in, because he also touched on how the city probably didn't share costs when giving that $200 million figure. But also that the money that is coming in, especially the money on hotel stays, and as we're talking about all the extra policing, that's not staying in the local economy. And he called this a leakage.
And so a leakage is in economics is when money gets spent in a place but doesn't stick in a place. So, for example, in a normal week in your hotel room, you pay for your hotel costs, and about two-thirds of money on average ends up in the pockets of workers and other folks around there. But during a convention week or during a Super Bowl or something like this, hotel room prices are way, way up, and they're going to be way up during the Republican National Convention. But you're not doubling or tripling the number of hours of your worker or the wages of your workers at those hotels. So none of that money sticks in Milwaukee in the hands of local residents and local laborers. That all goes back to corporate headquarters back in New York City and spread across stockholders around the world. So you've got money being spent in Milwaukee, but it's not actually benefiting Milwaukeeans. It's benefiting corporate shareholders across the world.
The last thing I'd love to ask you is, you know, you'd been to Cleveland for the RNC when it happened, and then you've returned back to talk to venues and business owners. What's the final prediction you can make for Milwaukee? What should we expect when the RNC comes to town?
Mm. Yeah, that's a big question. I think if Cleveland provides a blueprint for what we might expect here, who's to say if it will, but if Cleveland provides a blueprint for what we can expect here, I think that the businesses, the bars and restaurants that are very close to the convention site, very close to Fiserv, will probably see a lot of business during the convention. Those that are outside of the security perimeter and still relatively close to Fiserv will have kind of a mixed results. So depending on if the convention goers venture out to those places or not, they could see a decent week of business, or they might not see any business. I think that the Third Ward might struggle with getting people to come out to some of those restaurants and bars unless they are making a push to their regulars to still come out. A lot of what I did here in Cleveland, even from businesses that lost out and didn't get the business that they were expecting, was that they still thought it was a good thing for the city, and they thought that it did shine a positive light on Cleveland and that they were able to show off their city on the national stage. At the same time, we don't know what's going to happen at the convention, if there might be unrest or not. So it's hard to say what ultimately the picture of Milwaukee will be that we'll present to the world. But what I heard time and time again from people in Cleveland was that they thought it was a good opportunity to kind of showcase the city on a larger stage. So I hope that that's what happens here too.
That was Sarah Volpenhayn from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with Visit Milwaukee this week, and they explained how they reached their economic impact estimates. You can find that story at WUWM.com. And if you have questions about the upcoming RNC, fill out our election survey. There's a link to that on our website as well. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the Animal Behavioral Program at Carroll University, which gives students hands-on experience through fostering and training dogs. But first, McKinley Beach in Milwaukee is back open. It's been closed for a couple years after several drownings. We'll tell you what's been done to improve safety next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's been about a month since the Milwaukee County Parks reopened McKinley Beach. It was initially closed in 2020 after at least four people drowned. Since then, the beach has undergone a $1 million construction project to address erosion and riptide concerns and lower the depth of the water. But like all county beaches, McKinley Beach still has no lifeguards on duty. We'll learn about the reconstruction project and lifeguard staffing in just a moment. But first, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez caught up with a few McKinley beachgoers to hear their thoughts on the beach reopening.
My name is Elise Reinbacher, and I'm at the beach because I'm off of work and it's really nice out today. It's super chill, there's not a lot of people, and it's really cute with all the rocks and everything. I don't have any concerns, I think, just as long as you're like aware of your surroundings, that kids have parents and stuff like that. But for the most part, I've seen all children be like occupied and with parents, and then the rest of that, it's just like teenagers or adults.
Melly Lewis. We come down here often, but this is a nice part of the beach to come down to, especially with the little kids. We're just kind of dipping our feet, but you know, if we come back later this summer, which we will, we'll be really careful about actually getting in the water, but we really love it down here, so we want to give it a try, but it is definitely concerning. I know they probably wouldn't open it if there were still concerns, so right. We're happy about it.
Aaron Pratton. I love swimming, I love the water, I love taking ice baths. It's heaven to me. It is just my natural state to be in the water. The waves are great, they do push it around a little bit, but it's nothing like the ocean where it's too hard, so it is very comfortable. As long as you're careful, I don't see no concerns about that. I mean, always watch your kids, always make sure that if you are swimming, swim with people around you, make sure they know you're around, but other than that, just have a great time.
We'll now hear Lake Effect's Excret Nunez speak with Milwaukee County Parks Planning Manager Sarah Toomson and the Assistant Director of Recreation, Andrea Wallace.
Sarah, tell me about the new design of the beach.
So the new design of the beach is actually the old design of the beach. We looked back at the original construction plans for the beach, and that was one of five options that we studied when we looked at the situation at McKinley Beach and evaluated the possible impacts that had caused drownings and near drownings and were the reason for the closure of the beach. So when we considered all of the options available to us, which did range from full closure to reconfigurations of new beach designs, offshore jetties, establishing a wetland in place of the beach, and also considering the original design configuration of the beach, Milwaukee County elected to pursue reconfiguration of the beach as it was initially designed in the late 1980s.
Yeah, so what are the key issues that this new beach design addresses?
So what we did when we began studying McKinley Beach was we looked at the existing conditions of the beach, and we also looked at the drowning events and near drowning events that had taken place, because we were able to pinpoint those dates and look back at weather and other information to see if there was a certain situation that was present at McKinley Beach that caused more risk for swimmers. And that was a study that we did with a team of coastal engineers, landscape architects, and other planners to take a look and consider all of those possibilities. There are many things that happen at McKinley Beach because of its unique location and configuration. And what I mean by that is there is the government pier wall, which actually reflects waves into the beach. And then there are also waves that arrive and come straight into the beach between the breakwaters. So those waves together actually form transverse waves, or waves that are in the shape of an S, and can be quite complicated for an inexperienced swimmer. We also realized that we had lost a lot of sand material at the beach. And between those breakwaters, where we had originally intended to have 2.5 feet of water for wading, we had over 6 feet in 2020. So through the loss of sand material and the complicating factors of the waves that were arriving at the beach, currents were the result, and unfortunately it was a risk to public safety. When we have deeper water, the wave energy is able to come up into the beach farther, and it doesn't dissipate until it's within those beach breakwaters. So that is another additional force of energy that you actually can't see with your eye when you're looking at the water and saying, will I go for a swim today? That's something that you would not be able to observe with your naked eye. So those things were present. And then just one step further, it was also observed that there is a condition that happens from time to time at McKinley Beach called a seiche. Mm-hmm. And a seiche event is when there's a vertical oscillating wave that arrives at the beach. Or the way it's been described, I've heard, is like if you had a cereal bowl and you pushed the bowl and created a wave within the milk in your cereal, there is a wave that takes place and it rocks back and forth against the side of your bowl. That actually happens within Lake Michigan. Mm. So at high wind events or certain situations, you can get these seiche events that happen in Lake Michigan. And while the Great Lakes are not tidal, we do have that kind of event that also is hard to observe with your naked eye. So all of these factors combined were addressed through the design that our coastal engineer team undertook, and they used computer modeling, hydrodynamic modeling, which was really just an emerging science in the 1980s when the beach was initially designed. We were able to use that and use computers to suggest different events that could take place at the beach. And then we also went out to the site and physically used dye to put it in the water and test to see what was happening in certain conditions, and use drone footage to evaluate actually what was happening within the water.
Wow. So it's really addressing so many different factors and key points of the beach and what the issues were.
Right. It's really a multitude of factors, which also makes it very hard to say what problem you need to solve to get to a safe beach. That is why we did the most we could to address all we could and bring this wading beach back to its original design, because we feel that that shallower water allows for less wave run-up and less wave energy within the beach, which keeps swimmers safer.
And so I understand that the beach was actually scheduled to open last summer. What were some of the obstacles along the way that delayed the reopening of this beach?
So as with any project on the Great Lakes, it is important that we work with the regulatory agencies to make sure that the work that we have planned is safe and permitted. And this is one of our most valued natural resources in Milwaukee. Everyone loves the lakefront. And so we did work with the Wisconsin DNR to achieve that permitting, as well as the Army Corps of Engineers. So at the beach site, there are actually two sides of it, right? There's the side that is above the waterline and then the side that is below the waterline. And those take different types of permits. So when we approached bidding and construction, we did finally resolve the elevation of our beach design that we were seeking to achieve for that summer. And we used that to create the final bid documents that went out for permitting. Some of those permits do take time. And so we had our permits to work above the waterline before we had our permits to work in the waterline. We decided to get moving and people saw a lot of action at the beach, but we did need to wait for the right permits in order to be able to move equipment into the water.
That makes sense. And I also know that the marina pier structure is there. Did that cause any obstacles or issues?
The government pier, as we call it, actually is one of the originating points of McKinley Beach. The government pier was constructed around 1892, and by cutting off those longshore currents, sand and sediment actually started to build up behind the government pier, and it was used as a beach for years and years before Milwaukee County constructed this engineered beach design in the late 1980s. So because of that location, while it likes to encourage sediment to be trapped behind that government pier, it also does reflect waves. And those waves can crash together as there are also waves that are coming straight in from Lake Michigan. And those crashing energy forces create unique currents that are problematic for the beach. So through the design of the breakwaters, it's our hope that we can dissipate most of that energy before it reaches the waiting area.
Right. And like I mentioned earlier, it's been a month since the beach has reopened. How have you noticed the beach conditions improve, or have things been going smoothly?
So far, so good. We're getting positive reaction from folks who are able to enjoy the beach again. There is a lot more sand at the beach today than there was 4 years ago when we had deeper water and less sand play area. So people are enjoying that. It's a great place to bring families. We were able to do some renewals at the playground that's nearby and provide new playground surfacing. So it's a nice place to spend the day, and people have been sharing their gratefulness for being able to visit the beach again.
And Andrea, even with the increased safety measures that have been taken to create this new McKinley redesigned beach, there are still no lifeguards on duty. So why is that?
So during the pandemic, our lifeguard corps was shut down in 2020. And so it has taken us several years to rebuild. So McKinley Beach, though, has not had lifeguards in decades.
Wow.
So Bradford Beach was the last beach that we guarded, and that was in 2019. Mm-hmm. So the goal would be to, you know, grow our lifeguard corps so that we can guard those beaches at some point. But our focus has been to guard our pools and get all of our aquatic centers open, continue to open our splash pads and wading pools. So really focusing on ensuring that there's access to water within each neighborhood. And then the beach we'll focus on as we grow our lifeguard corps.
So what goes into the decision-making process of whether a pool or a beach will be staffed with lifeguards for the summer?
I think equity and access. Really, access to water is an incredibly important part of our community. So ensuring that we have our neighborhood pools open is primarily our focus right now.
And you mentioned that you're still rebuilding. Milwaukee County Parks saw a 36% increase.
36%? Woo woo.
From last year's lifeguard recruitment efforts. But that's still not all fully staffed. What's the ideal number?
The ideal number would be about 250 lifeguards. So that would be able to open all of our pools and then give us the option of looking at the beaches. Guarding open water is far different than guarding a deep well pool. So we would have a lot of work cut out for us. But once we get to that point, we would definitely look at that. So, you know, we still have a lot of work ahead of us, but we've accomplished a lot this last year. So 36% increase is huge. And we were able to open additional facilities this year with that extra staffing.
So just to clarify, you said the special number would be 250 fully staffed. What's the number that we are at right now?
We are at 136 right now.
Yeah. So what are some of the possible factors that helped boost that lifeguard recruitment this summer?
So we increased our pay. We worked with a lot of community partners. So the Milwaukee Parks Foundation, Summerfest, Wheel and Sprocket, the Brewers Community Foundation. And those community partners found it really important to donate tickets or, you know, a bike to raffle off, all sorts of things like that. So incentivize the staff, give additional bonuses. So we really think that that recruitment effort that we started back in November is why we've ended up where we are in May. And so now we're opening pools and focusing on recruiting for 2025. So we have a new recruitment coordinator within our aquatics department, and she's really focusing on getting out in the community and recruiting people who can swim or teaching people how to swim so that we have that pipeline built.
So there are no lifeguards on duty at the beach, but there are programs like Beach Ambassadors. How do projects like these help support beachgoers?
So the beach ambassadors go out and provide information on how to swim in open water and ways to stay safe. So you'll find them walking up and down Bradford Beach or McKinley Beach and handing out information and talking to people who are there, ensuring that you're keeping an eye on your kids and saying, hey, you know, keep them within, you know, arm's range, that sort of thing. Providing tips on how to stay safe, pointing out the safety equipment that's there. So the ring buoys, ask people, what do you do if you get into an emergency? So really just providing that information. And we work really closely with the beach ambassadors so that they can go out to our beaches and give that information to the public.
Absolutely. So, Sarah, before we wrap up, I'm wondering, what needs to be done to keep this beach this way, to keep this design for years to come?
A part of what we are committed to is monitoring this beach into the future. That includes plans for bathymetric or underwater surveys so that we know how much sand material is present under the water and how deep the water is. We can't control Lake Michigan's water elevation, but we can react to it. And so it's our hope that through that monitoring, we would be able to see a trend if McKinley Beach was getting deeper over time or there were different current actions taking place, that we would be able to react and make a project to address that specific need. We also do plan to groom McKinley Beach as we do our swimming beaches more than weekly so that it stays clean, level, and it's able for folks to safely use as they enter and exit the water.
Well, Sarah and Andrea, thank you both so much for speaking with me today and telling me more about McKinley Beach's reopening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Toomson is the Principal Landscape Architect and Assistant Director of Planning at Milwaukee County Parks. Andrea Wallace is the Assistant Director of Recreation and Business Services, also for the park system. They spoke with Lake Effects expert Nunez. Wisconsin is a hot spot for Lyme disease. Cases are rising as climate change and development alter how humans interact with the ticks that transmit this disease. The numbers reported each year have more than doubled in the last two decades. With tick season underway, tick checks are one of the most important ways you can prevent infection. WUWM's Lena Tran went to a lab at UW-Madison, where researchers are using a new tool to teach people how to do tick checks. Mannequins.
Their names are Vanessa and Valerie. Both are tall brunettes, both dressed in sportswear, and both covered in dead black-legged ticks, the species that carries Lyme. Tila Jemsch is a research specialist at the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease, where scientists study ways to control ticks and prevent infection. Jemsch says the lab found the mannequins on Facebook Marketplace. At first, Vanessa was supposed to stand in for a human in a study on how ticks attach themselves to people. But soon they realized she could be useful as an educational tool. Now they have a whole family of mannequins.
So we've got child mannequins, we've got teenagers, we've even got preteen mannequins. That way, the event that we take it to, it's set up for who's going to be looking at the mannequins.
Ticks are notoriously tough to spot. A few years ago, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shared this photo of a poppy seed muffin. There were five ticks camouflaged among the seeds. The idea was show people how small they can be, encourage them to stay vigilant. The internet was grossed out. Later, the CDC tweeted an apology, saying they didn't mean to tick people off. But here's the thing. You're not very likely to run into ticks on a muffin. So when you're teaching the public how to spot the tiny arachnids, wouldn't it be better to show them what ticks look like on a person?
What ticks gonna look like? So this was an idea of how to get it in a context people are gonna see. They're not gonna see it in an image. They're not gonna see it under a microscope lens. They're probably gonna run into a tick on themselves. And what does that look like?
I went to the lab to learn how the plastic people are helping the researchers' outreach efforts and test out my own tick spotting skills.
Pretend this is your friend. She's okay. Just gone hiking and she's asked you to check her for ticks. Okay. So see you. I'll let you know, point out to me if you think you found one, and I'll let you know if you found it.
Okay, she is like a brunette in all black performance clothing. Here's one.
Yep.
On her like waist. That one was easy, which makes it feel like a trick because it's a lot bigger. Is that one?
That is one.
Oh, it's on her arm.
The two mannequins are nearly identical, except Vanessa is wearing all black. She also has classic bangs. Valerie keeps her hair in a side part, and she's dressed in white. Wearing light-colored clothing is an important part of tick prevention. Ticks are much harder to detect on dark clothes.
It's hard to tell whether it's like a stain or if it's just an actual tick, which is really tough.
Adult ticks are the biggest and easiest to see. It's the baby nymphs that you really need to hunt for. Ticks don't carry the bacteria that causes Lyme on their own. They have to draw blood from wildlife hosts like deer or mice first. The bacteria spreads when an infected tick bites another animal, like a human. When a tick bites you, they can hang on for days. As they feed, they'll swell, coming close to tripling in size. That's why it's important to do a tick check soon after you spend time outdoors. If you find and remove ticks right away, there's less time for bacteria to spread.
Poor Vanessa. She's in trouble. She, like, went off trail for sure.
Oh, yeah. She definitely went hiking and some brushwhacking. But, you know, she was out enjoying the day, and it's important that she's doing her tick check. So thank you for helping her.
Okay, here is a big one on her sock.
Yep.
And then is that one, or is it just, like, a piece of dirt? It's really hard to tell.
You tell me. What do you think?
Oh, I touched it. Maybe that's cheating. Okay, I think that's a piece of dirt.
Zemsh walks me over to Valerie, who's wearing the same outfit as Vanessa, but in white.
So this was another experiment that we did. We wanted to see, like, how black clothing and white clothing would affect them. Uh-huh. So she's got the exact same ticks that applied to her in the same spots. Uh-huh. So you did a really good job.
Zemsh says my performance on the test pretty much mirrors what they've learned from the demos at public events. People are better at finding ticks on white clothes than dark clothes. They're also better at spotting them on the upper body than the lower body. And people are much better at finding adult ticks than the young, tiny nymphs. Zemsh points to one that's the size of a sesame seed, which I missed on the black pair of tennis shoes, but they're easy to see on the white shoes.
I recognize these pants from Target.
They are exactly from Target, yes. Good eye.
I think I have the same ones as her.
Honestly, it was really cute. I went to go buy the mannequins' outfits, and then I came back a week later to purchase those in my size. Beautiful.
Well, now I'm like, I should have gotten the white ones.
White ones, yeah. I mean, cute, but yeah, it does really make you think, right?
When you bring them out to events and things like that, what is kind of the average success rate that you're getting?
So, great question. The average success rate when we took these out for the surveys, we had 16 ticks that were attached to them, and the average found was 7.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The researchers are using these results to come up with recommendations for more successful tick checks.
So, first off, before I ever start my hike, I'm going to make sure that I tuck my pants into my socks, my shirt into my pants, so I don't have as much of a access to the skin for the ticks. It gives me more chances to spot them. And then when I'm done with my hike, or done with my hike or time outdoors, I start at my feet and then I work my way up. So I will check every little crevice. If I'm wearing shoes that have like flaps or folds into them, I also want to make sure I peel that back and look at that. I then will kind of make my way up my legs, and I'll just keep checking seams. I'll keep checking anything that looks even a little bit like a tick. If I've got a friend with me, I'll ask them to check my back, because I'm unlike our mannequins here, it's not quite as easy for me to see my back. I will then take my clothes and I'll put them into the dryer. So if I missed anything, the ticks will hopefully desiccate into the dryer. Showering afterwards helps too. I like to use insect repellent. So that also works with repelling ticks. So I'll make sure I use something like DEET or Picaridin so that I can hopefully have less of them on me. And then the ones that I do find with that tucking in and like methodic check from down up, can get anything else.
If you do find a tick on you, you can take a photo and send it to experts to identify.
So we actually have a app called the Tick App that you can send in photos for identification of what the tick is. And by how big the tick is, people can actually tell how long it's been feeding. And depending on how long ticks have been attached, different pathogens transmit over different amounts of time. So there is kind of like a rate that you can tell of how big the tick is, roughly how long it was on you, and then if you should be worried about potentially a tick-borne pathogen.
What should people do at that point if they find a tick on them?
If it hasn't attached to you, you want to make sure that you remove it from yourself. If it has attached to you, it's really, really important actually that what you do is you take tweezers or some kind of instrument that you can pluck the tick. But you want to make sure that you get down as close to your skin as possible. They've got this it's called a hypostome. It's like a little straw, essentially, that they put into your skin. You want to get as close to that as possible. Pinch that and then pull up, twist a little bit. What you really want to make sure that you don't do is grab the tick by its body, because if you do that, you'll essentially cause them to regurgitate what's in their stomach into you, and that could potentially have pathogens. So you don't want to have them, you know, vomit or throw up pathogens into you. So you want to get down to as close to that straw as possible and then pull up.
As climate change makes our winters warmer, Wisconsin is seeing longer tick seasons. The spread of Lyme disease is also influenced by wildlife populations and land use changes that are pushing people and development further into tick territory. All of this means it's becoming more and more important to make tick checks a routine part of being outside.
Is to spend time doing the tick checks, really doing it in a methodical way, spending your time on it and making sure that you're really checking everything. I mean, you know, the tick checks, I like them. I still do them every single time I go on a walk. But now, having done this study, there's just things that I'm also making sure that I do, like really making sure I'm tucking clothes in and spending time. You know, it's not just something to kind of check off the list when I'm done hiking. It's something really important. I want to make sure that I can stay healthy and keep enjoying the outdoors. So spending time on it, being really diligent about it.
Wow, now I need to go exchange my pants for the white ones.
They are cute, too.
Yeah, they are.
That was researcher Tila Jemsch, plus her lab assistants Vanessa and Valerie. For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran. And I'd like to check you for ticks.
I know the perfect little path. That was WUWM's Lena Tran at the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. Coming up, we'll learn about Carroll University's Animal Behavior Program, a college course that comes with a dog. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'll keep you safe, you wait and see. The only thing allowed to crawl all over you when we get there. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you've ever daydreamed about hanging out with a dog during your college exams, Carroll University's Animal Behavior Program could be for you. The program gives students an opportunity to do hands-on work by pairing them with dogs from the Humane Animal Welfare Society of Waukesha. But the university isn't just handing out dogs. The course teaches students what it's like to be the main caretaker for a dog, how to juggle a variety of responsibilities, and how to overcome challenges with training. Sophia Najem is a graduate of the program, and Dr. Lee Kesting is an assistant professor at Carroll. They join me to share more about this unique program. So Dr. Lee, tell me a bit about this program. How is it set up?
It's set up as a joint relationship between Humane Animal Welfare Society of Waukesha County, so HAWS, and Carroll University, where the dogs actually come to HAWS from transports, primarily from the Southeast United States. Myself and the lab instructor, Leanne Boucher, pick out the dogs that we think are best fitting for the program. They get placed into foster homes. So the dogs, as they come in, because they come in various times between Thanksgiving and New Year's, are placed in a matching foster home. And then starting early January, the students actually take over that foster dog and have the foster dog with them for the entire semester. So starting the week before classes to finals, the students are responsible 24/7 for those dogs with guidance from myself and the other instructor, and they get to live, breathe, and work dogs every single day.
So, Sophia, you're involved in this program. What was it that attracted you to it?
I've always wanted to work with dogs. I've worked with dogs from a really early age, so it was just a really good program. I was really fortunate that Carroll offered it when they did, and it was an opportunity I really couldn't pass up because I would be able to get that hands-on experience of being with a dog 24/7. I've never had my own dog, so this is a little different for me. So I'm seeing a lot of different perspectives I've never seen working and training, you know, other people's dogs. So that was the biggest cherry on top, is I kind of have that feeling of what it's like to have my own dog.
Well, I think that's the big question for people who might be hearing this conversation. What are your students learning through this program?
So this is actually a full year-long course. So the students take one semester in the fall that focuses on canine management, training, behavioral challenges, basically dog 101. And it's not just the training skills that we're hoping for them to learn. We're really hoping for them to learn the science behind how we use canine management. So what is the literature telling us? What has the peer-reviewed process been for this entire training style? And then how do you apply the science to actually dog training? And that second semester, their goal really is to get that hands-on experience. It's not as easy as it always seems to people. So Sophia can probably speak more to her relationship with Drax, her dog right now. But we have students who are managing things like reactivity. We have students who are managing some kennel separation distress. We have students who are managing various not eating, needing to walk 4 miles in the middle of the winter, and a variety of other factors. So I think the big thing to take away is, yes, it's great that they have dogs, but a big goal is really for them to learn how truly rounded they have to be in training. And it's not simply just, okay, I train for an hour a day and then I'm good to go and I go to classes and all of that. It's more of, this is how fostering dogs work. If you want to have any kind of service dog training, this is going to be even more intense. And then also, how do you manage behavior as a college student? Because no dog, when it goes into a home, is perfect. And there's lots of challenges to overcome.
So Sophia, how has this experience been with the dog that you have? What are some of the unique challenges it presents?
The biggest thing has been the food, because I've never had a dog. I never realized how picky dogs could be, because I just show up to people's houses. I use a few treats. I train their dog. I leave. You know, that's a wrap. So really getting used to actually trying to get a dog to eat. I was like, do I not know how to feed a dog? Like, this is ridiculous. And I was like, Dr. Lee, I think this food's not working for us anymore. I tried different options. It's not going well, but we made that adjustment. With Drax, he's a really cool dog. He has a lot of energy. So the biggest thing is kind of keeping his arousal level at a good, safe place where we can learn to kind of play together without him over-escalating. And that's, I would say, our biggest challenge that we're working through right now.
You know, as we look toward the kind of practical uses for this, I think anyone who has a dog will know there's a lot of ways that you can use that. I think to myself, my own dogs have had their own issues with eating or needing to use up energy in more constructive ways. Aside from, you know, the future of possibly owning a dog yourself, what are the other ways you can use these skills?
Just working with clients, being able to apply this to future clients. I have a job, so I'm going to be doing that and having this experience to really shape different perspectives, different alternatives, different options to provide resources and management opportunities for my clients to make their relationship better with their dog.
And I think the other thing to note is that some of these students do want to be dog trainers. Some of these students want to go into more of an animal-assisted intervention route, so they're looking to either train service dogs or help in therapy organizations. Some of the students want to work with elementary school kids and having dogs come into school. And some of these students want to be other animal trainers. So sometimes this translates to dolphin training or bird training. So the principles they're learning is really what matters here. And part of this is hands-on experience is really to get them some critical thinking skills. Even though we are on call 24/7, I mean, there are times they have to process through that information that they're seeing and make a choice. And while we've tried to prepare them the best we can, certainly there are challenges where they have to act. And so part of it is them gaining the skills to communicate their needs, practice advocating for an animal or advocating for themselves, and also ensuring that they are managing still their college career. And frankly, I think that's a reflection of how many different things are happening as a college student. They spend 4 to 6 hours a day working with these dogs on top of classes and jobs and volunteer work. The end thing may be, yes, these dogs are trained and that's lovely. No dog will be trained perfectly in 4 months, but they're growing in that. But the students also just get a lot of life skills that we think really round out their Carroll experience.
Well, Sophia, Lee, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your experiences.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Lee Kestein is an assistant professor of animal behavior, and Sophia Najem is a Carroll University graduate. They spoke with me in 2022. And a note to our listeners, Carroll University is a financial supporter of WUWM. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Lake Effect is off tomorrow for the holiday, so instead at noon, you'll hear a show about AI called Possible. The show features interviews with experts who envision a future where technology helps things go right for humanity. Through technology and collective action, Possible explores how we might achieve an ideal world. That's tomorrow at noon. Lake Effect will be back next Monday, when we'll hear some of our latest voter roundtable. Join us on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.